We're making changes to the way we provide heat and light, but apparently we're not making them fast enough. New numbers released this week show that carbon emissions jumped in 2018, even though we continue to close coal-fired power plants, which are big contributors to carbon emissions. The news probably does not surprise our guests this hour, who already wrote a book pointing out that we need to decarbonize at a much faster rate if we have any hope of arresting climate change. Joshua Goldstein and Stefan Kvist make the case for all kinds of non-carbon power, including nuclear, in their book A Bright Future, How Some Countries Have Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow. Joshua Goldstein wrote the book on international relations. I mean, really, he's a political scientist who wrote a textbook by the title International Relations. He's written several other books. He's Professor Emeritus of International Relations at American University. Joshua Goldstein, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be with you.
Stefan Kvist got his training as a nuclear engineer. Now he works on clean energy projects of many kinds in many countries. Stefan Kvist, thank you for joining us.
It's great to be with you.
And Stefan, why don't we just go right to the heart of most people's concerns? Because you've been working with nuclear power, it sounds like a long time. Can it be safe?
What we have seen is kind of a misconception about safety and the definitions of safety. If you define it, there's various ways of defining it, but if you define it as the impact on humans and in the environment, the safety track record, if we look at nuclear power as an industry, if you would find me any industry and you present the case that they've been operating for over 60 years with hundreds of thousands of people employed in hundreds of locations across the world, and apart from one facility in the Soviet Union built and operated in an environment that wouldn't be allowed anywhere else, we haven't had anyone harmed or died from that industry. Whatever industry that would be, it could be a button factory or whatever, that would be like a leader in safety. So the cold hard numbers point towards the nuclear industry as being a very safe industry, but a lot of people are still afraid of it. So there's a kind of a mismatch between the facts and the public perception there.
All right, so even if the operation is safe, what about the long-term storage of the waste products of nuclear power generation? What do we do with those?
Yeah, so we're jumping right into it. Yeah, again, it's kind of the same perception issue. So we have nuclear waste, which has been a big discussion topic since the inception of civilian nuclear power. But again, it's never harmed anyone. So it's kind of a puzzling thing that we discuss this issue and the safety implications of something that's been around for quite a long time now in many different countries, but never really harmed anyone. It is a challenge to store nuclear waste safely, but the volumes are quite small, and we do have solutions. My neighboring country, Finland, is already building their repository for nuclear waste. Sweden has an approved plan to do it as well. It's going a bit slower in other countries, but it's not really a pressing problem. I mean, we have safe interim storage solutions for this. We definitely need to work on solving the long-term issue, but we have a very much more pressing issue, which is the global climate and the air pollution that's coming out of our current energy system. And that's a time-pressing issue, whereas the nuclear waste is not so much of a time-pressing issue.
Right, which is the real point of the book. And I appreciate you letting me jump right in there. I figured I wanted to address some of the major concerns that people will have right up front. Joshua Goldstein, as the non-engineer on this team, I wonder if you took some convincing on the nuclear power end.
Well, sure. I grew up in the Bay Area back in the 60s and 70s, and I was an environmentalist. We thought back to the land was good, nature good, technology not so much, and small is beautiful. So I didn't like nuclear power one little bit. And then what happened is I had children, and my children said, climate change is the big issue. You're leaving us a real horrible problem. Everybody should work on climate change and solve it. So I'm the big global trends person in international relations, and this is sure a big global trend. So I started looking at it seriously with an eye to how could you actually solve climate change. Everybody was talking about steps in the right direction. If we recycle more, or if we build more wind turbines, or if we do this or that, it'll all be steps in the right direction. It's clear now that it's not adding up. And you just cited the numbers that emissions are still going up, much less dropping rapidly as they need to do. So if you do the math and you look at all the options, it becomes pretty clear that nuclear power uniquely can scale up very fast to provide the kinds of clean energy that the world's going to need in the next 30 years. And nothing else right now can do that.
So the steps aren't enough. You're saying we essentially need to make a quantum leap in what we're doing.
Yeah, we need almost a paradigm shift about what we're doing, that each individual trying to do better and use less energy and all this, it's not adding up. And the world has spent $2 trillion in the last decade on renewables, but emissions haven't gone down at all. Stefan can give you the numbers from Germany where, again, emissions haven't gone down despite all kinds of efforts with renewables. The one place they have gone down is in the countries that have used nuclear power, Sweden, France, Ontario, Canada, where they've rolled out a series of reactors really fast and the emissions just dropped dramatically. That's what we need for the world as a whole. And we have to do it in the next 30 years. That's what the climate scientists tell us. We may not feel the effects in the next 30 years, but that's when we're in danger of hitting these tipping points that could really make the world uninhabitable in the future.
Stefan Quist, we're heading up to a break. It's about a minute away. I just want to get in before that about how much energy we're still drawing from fossil fuel sources. The number's rather surprising, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you might think from watching the news that this is diminishing, but actually it's basically unchanged for the last decades. It's dropping, but incredibly slowly, the fraction of our energy that's coming from fossil. But since our total energy demand in the world is increasing, the actual amount of energy we're drawing out of fossil fuels is not dropping. So really, it's a dire situation we're in.
So it's still 85% is what we're drawing from fossil fuels at this point around the world?
Something, yeah, 83 to 85%, something like that, yeah.
Wow, so even if we made the commitment today, I mean, we're talking about a fairly long-term switchover without some major component like nuclear power, you're saying.
This is a really, really big problem to solve, yes. It's the big problem that we have today.
All right, much more to talk about with Stefan Quist and Joshua Goldstein, the authors of A Bright Future, How Some Countries Have Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow. You can join the conversation by phone and email. We'll talk more with them and talk with you when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about the future of the Earth and its climate. And the climate continues to change. We continue to put carbon into the atmosphere, and we're not making changes fast enough, certainly in the eyes of the authors of a book called A Bright Future, How Some Countries Have Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow. They're making the case that small steps aren't enough. We need to make a big leap forward in decarbonizing our energy production, and that includes things like nuclear power. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We've been talking about a lot of the engineering considerations thus far, Joshua Goldstein, but those aside, I mean, how fast can human thinking switch?
Well, it can switch pretty fast when the mind gets concentrated. I'd like to stress on the human thinking and whole political side of this issue that we have a tendency in the United States to think that U.S. policy is the important thing here. But actually, although the U.S. is a big contributor to carbon emissions in the world, China is now emitting more than the U.S. and the European Union combined. And in the upcoming years and decades, big, poor countries like India and Indonesia are going to be growing their energy use really fast. And this is where the thinking maybe needs to change more than just the United States putting in a bunch of clean energy. We need a way for people in India who don't have electricity and are getting on the grid to get that electricity without turning to coal, which is right now the leading source of generation in the world, and it's the cheapest, most practical way for some farmer in India to get an air conditioner is to power it with coal. So you can't just tell that person you can't have electricity because we've already used up the carbon budget of the world, we the rich countries. You have to have something practical and affordable that can replace the coal. And we think that nuclear power is the thing that could do that because the quantities are so vast and the speed at which we need to act is so fast.
So it is not so much the United States, which is at least making its efforts, but we're talking about the developing world, and people who are getting things for the first time are going to be getting them with electricity powered by coal.
That's right. And if I could say a couple of words about coal, it is the leading source of energy. It's the fastest growing source of energy in the world in the 21st century. And it's deadly. In addition to putting out carbon emission, it puts out particular matter that makes people sick with emphysema and cancer. Worldwide, it kills literally hundreds of thousands of people every year. So people talk about, oh, is nuclear power safe? Well, I'll tell you, coal's not safe, that's for sure. And the thing is, replacing coal, it's a pretty concentrated source of energy. If you take a pound of coal, though, and you turn it into electricity, you can power your average American house for about half an hour. But, 1 hour for a pound. But if you take that same pound of nuclear fuel and turn it into electricity, you can power the house for 2 years. And this is why nuclear can scale so fast. It's so concentrated. It's also why the waste problem is so small, because the waste is also very small volumes. And there are other ways to replace coal, including renewables, and we're all for them. As fast as you can go, that's great. But it's not going to power up fast enough to take up the demand from all the Indian and Indonesians decarbonizing the United States and Europe and powering China's continuing growth and then switching over things that have been powered by liquid and gaseous fuels like home heating and cars and making those electric. So put all of that together, you just need a huge amount of new clean electricity in the world, and nuclear power can do it because it's so concentrated.
Stefan Kvist, the idea of clean coal, I want to make sure we address that. Is that a real thing in any form?
In theory, it could be a real thing. The thing that is called clean coal today is a scam. It's just coal with the word clean in front of it. There are, in theory, technologies that could make coal cleaner, which basically has to do with capturing the emissions that come out of the coal plant and trying to put them underground rather than in the atmosphere. That is not being done in what is called clean coal today. So when you hear it today, that's more or less of a scam, I would say.
All right. Not surprisingly, we've got a few people who are trying to contact us to talk about this issue when we're talking about people speaking favorably about nuclear power. That's bound to be the case. Our guests are Joshua Goldstein and Stefan Kvist. Their book is A Bright Future, How Some Countries Have Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow. Let's start with Carter in Wolf Creek. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes. One of the people you have on, Jeff, just said that nobody's been injured by nuclear power.
Other than Chernobyl.
What about Fukushima? I mean, the lives of many, many people there turned upside down. Anyway, my main point here is that nuclear power and warfare and climate change are symptoms of a much deeper problem. And that is the relationship that we have with ourselves. And that is the point that I made in Stuart Brand's advocating for nuclear power 10 years ago. And I think, as I understand it, he's become quiet on the issue now. We do not understand ourselves. We have in the past. Native peoples were very careful about their behavior in relationship to the environment. But in terms of industrial education, even at the university level, we think we can run around and do just about anything we want to do, and that's not true. And if it's true, then our bodies would be quite different than they actually are. Our bodies are... You know, our personal bodies are very, very tightly controlled, and there's just so many things that can go wrong, and there are so many things that have to go right. And
all right, so we need to understand ourselves better. I think I get the point there, Carter. Thanks for the call on that. Let's move on to Pam and Dexter. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Joshua Goldstein and Stefan Kvist.
Hi. Well, first of all, I think it's really disingenuous to compare a button factory's accidents with a nuclear power plant accident. We all know how devastating nuclear waste and when a power plant has an accident, it lasts for decades, if not longer. A quick Google search showed nuclear accidents Fukushima, Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, Enrico Fermi, SL1, Idaho Falls, a place in Michigan, Windscale in the UK. So there's more than one accident, and when one accident happens, it's devastating. But obviously your guests are biased, as they have a career in nuclear energy. I'd much rather have an unbiased panel of people talking about solutions for energy that include the broad spectrum of what we have available. And I think the low-hanging fruit of energy resource conservation is something we need to talk about. It's ridiculous that we all expect to live this lavish lifestyle with limited resources, and even nuclear energy, it's not renewable. Uranium's going to run out. Once it's extracted, it is a limited resource. So I really have a hard time with your guests because they're obviously biased, and we need to be talking about, on a global scale, first of all, the developing countries piggybacking over the dirty energy we use and go to solar and limit our amount of energy we use and talk about energy conservation. Nuclear energy is not the solution, and I'll listen on the air.
Thanks. All right, Pam, thanks for that. So, Joshua Goldstein, let me ask you, though, the point she made about having to change our lifestyles, is that getting any traction? Do people think about terms of a future where they would have to be? Well, I mean, you talked about the people in India not being told they can't have an air conditioner. I can't imagine that would resonate very well in an already developed country.
You can't conserve your way to solving the problem when people in poor countries want a small fraction of the energy that we use now in the rich countries. I want to address the issue of the bias because I have no connection to the nuclear industry. I've never made any money from the industry. Mm-hmm. I'm an international relations professor. My entire agenda here is to figure out how we could actually solve climate change, not take a bunch of feel-good steps in the right direction that are fine in themselves, but they're not getting us there. And I just want to repeat this. The world's not on track to solve this problem. We need to act really fast. This is what the climate scientists tell us. And, you know, putting in solar panels is great. It's fine as far as it goes. But we need a lot of energy really fast. Now, we haven't talked about Fukushima, and I'd like to say something about it.
Sure.
There was the fourth worst earthquake in the history of the world at Fukushima, and a 50-foot tidal wave, and it killed like 18,000 people. And it did damage to the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, and leaked some radiation. But the radiation that leaked never exceeded, for the general public, the limit that's set for safe exposure to radiation, like if you go in for medical diagnostics or if you work in an industry where there might be radiation. There was never an unsafe level of radiation to which the public was exposed. There were 12 people working at the plant who did get higher doses, but they haven't shown to have any bad health effects yet, but that's 12 people. So 18,000 killed by this terrible catastrophe of the earthquake and tsunami, and then nobody killed. There were people who died because of the evacuation, because they yanked people out of hospitals suddenly and so forth, but the radiation itself didn't. And you can measure really small amounts of radiation, but it doesn't mean that they're harmful. We're all walking around in a soup of radiation every day. So that people crosswire the real disaster, which was this tsunami that killed 18,000 people, with the imagined nuclear disaster. And it was the same thing at Three Mile Island. The radiation never killed anybody there, very small amounts, a lot of damage to the plant. But it came out just as this disaster film, The China Syndrome, was in the movie theaters with Jane Fonda. And people just got the two things confused. Similarly, people confused nuclear power with nuclear weapons, because back in the Cold War, we were all terrified of nuclear weapons, and then we just kind of transferred it over to nuclear power. I did this myself when I was young. But a nuclear power plant cannot physically blow up like a nuclear bomb. They're two completely different things, although they have a similar physical process involved in them. So you have to sort out the hype and the fear. And like everybody knows how terrible these accidents are, all those accidents that were listed off at the Fermi plant and so forth, accidents do happen in every industry, but they're overall, per kilowatt hour, nuclear power is 400 times safer than coal. And yet we're burning all this coal every day because we're afraid of replacing it with nuclear power. And that's the number one thing we're calling for: get rid of the coal and build out nuclear power instead. We'd all be safer, and we'd be a lot closer to solving climate change.
Okay, we do have a fair number of phone calls and emails here, and I'm trying to get some of the technical stuff up front because we only have Stefan until about the next 7 minutes. So here's a call from David in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with the authors of A Bright Future.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have to admit, this is a pretty challenging topic for me, having come of age in the 60s and 70s mm-hmm. in this culture. But my question has to do with small-scale, village-size, city-size nuclear power technology. What's the state of that? Stuart Brand began this discussion several years back. Then, again, long-term storage of nuclear waste. It was just talked about in passing and not in depth, and I'd like to hear more about that.
All right. Thank you so much. Appreciate the call. So small-scale plants, the waste, and then let me throw in there Becca in Lane County asking about the status of cold fusion. Stefan, you're on.
Sure. Okay. There was a lot of things to cover. So the small-scale nuclear, I believe I'm on a radio station in Oregon, right?
Oregon and California, yes.
Yeah. So in the U.S., you have an Oregon-based company called NuScale that is the front runner of commercializing the small-scale nuclear technology based on the current type of technology we have now, and they're doing quite well. They're in the licensing process in the U.S. They have a customer for their plant, and so it remains to be seen whether they're able to produce them at cost levels that would be competitive, but it's looking pretty bright unless people get in the way of it. For the nuclear waste issue, again, I would recommend anyone who's in Europe to go and visit a civilian nuclear waste facility and just look at how large the quantities are, and it's really not that scary when you see it up front. The Swedish nuclear waste program is stored in a swimming pool that you can come and visit, and you can stand next to it and look at it, and really that changed my perspective of visiting that and just being kind of surprised that this is actually the extent of the problem that's capturing a worldwide discussion. If you have waste that is dangerous essentially for all eternity from all kinds of industrial activities and chemical industries that no one really discusses the storage of at all. I think we really should care about how we store waste and toxic material that's dangerous for a long time or even forever. But we should do it in a way that's kind of neutral. So if some other industry is producing toxic chemicals that's dangerous forever, that should be equally on the agenda, I think. So when you focus strictly on one single industry's waste stream, it kind of skews the discussion a little bit.
You mentioned the water, though, and I know Grumpy John in Grants Pass has sent an email asking about the water that flows through the Fukushima plant and also about billions of gallons of toxic nuclear waste. There's the waste on one hand, but I guess I'm asking about the water more directly here. You talk about the water in that swimming pool sort of setup in Scandinavia.
Yeah, I mean, you can do it in different ways. In the U.S., it's stored in concrete casks. Sweden chose to have a kind of a swimming pool solution. But basically, you need to keep it away from people. You can be a few meters away from it. We shouldn't be really close to the waste. It's not really that dramatic when you see up a close.
For how long? I guess that's one of the major questions. How long?
Yeah, so the current waste you need to store for a very long time. Just kind of like when you have a big mining industry and they have toxic chemicals, those are chemically toxic forever. The nuclear waste does decay. Some of it decays very slowly, so it will still emit radiation that you need to be shielded from for a very long time. But in essence, it's not very much different from some toxic chemical that just is never going to be safe. And we also need to store that and keep that away from humans and the biosphere forever. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a skewed discussion where you have all this toxic waste produced in all kinds of industries, but we're very concerned about just one of them.
And then to Becca and her question about the status of cold fusion. I want to use your engineering brain before we lose you.
Yeah, it's that's a kind of an infected topic because there was some experiments done that couldn't be replicated a while back, a couple of decades back, and it's still kind of there's been some scam artists in that field, let's say. So it's not a commercially viable product, and the actual theory behind the reactions that would occur is not very well understood, even though people see net generation of energy. There's not really a comprehensively accepted theory for what's occurring. So it's a bit of a extremely early stage, let's say, and not really clear whether it will work.
So, but is there any technology that appears to be promising on the horizon that would perhaps produce as much electricity as the current nuclear plants do, but with a process that might require less fuel or less radioactive fuel or something?
If you drop the word cold in front of fusion and just have the regular hot fusion, let's say there are plenty of startups that are trying to commercialize various ways of achieving that, many of them in the U.S., and many of them actually quite well-funded. But they're not too public on their results. And there's a ways to go there. I think the main issue there is not whether it will work technically, because we're pretty sure we can make it work technically. I would see the main issue being, could you make it economically competitive? And that might be the biggest challenge.
But is that sort of like the questions that we have with renewable resources, where over time, if we just keep working on the technology, they can come down in cost?
They've come down amazingly in cost now, and they're cost competitive on, you know, a per megawatt basis. Solar and wind in many places are extremely cost competitive. What we see is, if we look at a complete system picture, so if you want to have a completely decarbonized system, it is much easier and cheaper to do with a combination of renewables and what we call firm low-carbon energy, which is something that you can schedule the production from, which basically means either hydroelectric power or nuclear power.
Okay, we have to take a
break.
That
combination is cheaper as a system. Even with very expensive nuclear power, it's cheaper as a system.
Okay, we're going to lose Stefan with this break. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll come back and talk with Joshua. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're having a lively discussion about the future of the world and where we're going to get our electricity from, because the guests that we've been talking to are talking about a future that includes nuclear energy. Joshua Goldstein and Stefan Kvist are the co-authors of A Bright Future, How Some Countries Have Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow. Stefan is the nuclear engineer, and he had to leave us with the break. We still have Joshua Goldstein with us. He is a political scientist and a professor of international relations, professor emeritus at American University. You can join us on the exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Another phone call here from Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, I'm wondering, in your calculations as to the marvelous nuclear power, have you determined how much greenhouse gas is produced every time you make cement? Cement produces huge amounts of greenhouse gas when it's made.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the major components of concrete, which is what keeps nuclear power from burning everybody up when it's being produced.
With the containment vessels, sure. Okay, let's ask that question. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate that. Joshua, have you guys looked at that very much, the intensity of carbon produced by the construction of nuclear power facilities?
I can't give you detailed figures on that, but again, because nuclear power is so concentrated, the facilities are very small compared to the amount of energy produced. You can use a lot of concrete putting out a solar farm too, and it's going to be much larger and use more material. So I can tell you confidently that you're getting a lot more clean energy out of nuclear than you're using for concrete. But it raises an interesting question, because there's some of these new companies that Stefan referred to, and some of the new designs are proposing to build nuclear power plants centrally rather than each one on site. And there's even a proposal to build them in shipyards and float them to where they're going. And so then you've got the steel. It's like building an offshore oil rig, which we're actually very good at, or building a large cargo ship in a shipyard. And it takes away the concrete element of it. So it may be that the nuclear power plants of the future, as we're cranking them out, would actually not be so concrete intensive as they are now. But I can tell you that the power plant is so small compared to all the other concrete that we're using that it's not a major contributor in any way.
So I want to come back to square one and just sort of restate the purpose of the book, because people can certainly get wrapped up in the nuclear power issue. But you're saying that at the rate we are burning up fossil fuels right now, we have to do something more than what we're doing in terms of changing over to renewables.
That's right. So we're trying to keep the world under two degrees of warming, and hopefully under 1.5 degrees before we run into the tipping points that could lead to catastrophic outcomes like a new ice age or 200-foot sea level rise, all these things, which will be after we're dead, but it's not the thing to do for our future generations. And the things we do in the next 30 years will be critical to that. People might think that because our carbon emissions have been rising and temperature has been rising, that all we need to do is steady out our carbon emissions at the level they are now. And that's about what the Paris Agreement does if everybody keeps their commitments. But that's not the way it is. The temperature rise is driven by the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. And what we need to do is stop putting any more as fast as we can into the atmosphere. So people talk about a carbon budget, like how much can it take before it drives the warming up way past this 2-degree mark. And so the climate scientists in this recent IPCC report, all the World Scientific Consortium on this, tell us that by mid-century, by about 2050, we should be stopping putting carbon in, and in fact, we need to start sucking it out of the atmosphere, which right now is tremendously expensive, but we need to figure ways to do that as well. So it's not just moving in the right direction, and it's not even just the scale of what we need to do. It's the speed at which we need to move that's so critical here.
You've mentioned already that this is not just an American situation, that it's not just an American political question either, but I do want to talk about this in terms of American politics, and I wonder, from your perspective, Joshua, which is the harder task, getting Republicans to accept climate change or getting Democrats to accept nuclear power?
Well, neither one is so easy right now, but the interesting thing is if you frame the conversation in terms of climate change, it's very divisive, and the Republicans say basically if Al Gore is for something, I'm against it, and vice versa. And the Democrats have their side of that argument too. But if you frame it in terms of practical solutions, where are we going to get clean energy from? There's a lot of Republican support for clean energy, be it conservative Governor Sam Brownback out in Kansas loved his wind power. It was good for the Kansas economy. Or the liberal senators like Sheldon Whitehouse and Cory Booker who have supported nuclear energy because they care about climate change. So if you focus on solutions, there's actually a lot of bipartisan support. Congress just passed a Nuclear Energy Innovation and Modernization Act, which is trying to support these new generation of reactors. And it passed with huge margins in both houses with a lot of bipartisan support. So that I find a hopeful thing. And then in terms of the other countries, I know you asked about America, but it's not such a political problem in China, for instance. If the government decides they want to build out nuclear reactors fast and get rid of coal, which would be a really good thing for very many reasons, they can just do it. And similar in some other countries. So it's a mix of politics in different countries. But in terms of the United States, there's good bipartisan support for nuclear. It's got the support of the majority, a slim majority of the population that actually favor nuclear power, although the opponents tend to be louder about it.
There's a reference in the book to climate refugees and the whole set of concerns that comes from people having to escape areas where it's too hot or the water's too high or whatever the circumstances have become because of the planet changing. And I wonder what you think about the possibility of human movement, about large numbers of refugees, for example, destabilizing political systems so that attention is once again diverted from the task at hand, which is converting to a non-carbon system.
It would be hard to divert the attention more than now when we're not solving the problem at all, but I take your point. There may well be large population movements. It's really hard to predict what's going to happen. And there's several things about climate change that make it a particularly difficult problem to solve. One of which I've mentioned is we have to take action now for things that are going to materialize off, decades in the future, even centuries. But another one is that we have to take definite action now that might cost money, but it's going to materialize in ways that are hard to predict. So maybe the world will be okay, maybe it won't, maybe 2 degrees is safe enough. Maybe we can get away with 3 degrees, maybe 1.5 is already too warm. Nobody knows for sure. So what we need to do as humanity is be prudent about it and make sure that we're getting our arms around the problem and coming up with real solutions to do the utmost that we can. And then to the extent that we don't get far enough, then we have the climate refugees and a host of other problems. I mean, I live in a place, I'm talking to you from Boston right now, mm-hmm. And this area was covered with a sheet of ice a mile thick just 12,000 years ago. So that's a geological possibility not that long ago. And the things, that makes it really hard to live if you've got a sheet of ice on top of your head.
Another phone call here, waiting a while. Anna in Wairika. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Joshua Goldstein.
Hi, Eureka.
Oh, Eureka, okay.
And that's what we want, isn't it? Eureka, we want a solution. But on a problem of this scale, the solution is going to always require sacrifice. And the question is, what are we willing to sacrifice lives and resources and money for? And I lived for 28 years with two 50-watt solar panels and four golf cart batteries, and in 28 years I used eight of those golf cart batteries, and I had plenty of light, plenty of radio, and a telephone. And so when you talk about third world needs and third world development, you're really talking about transportation when it comes to quality of life more than you are about energy in the home. So I'm absolutely don't think nuclear is a solution for the third world problem. But when it comes to this industrial needs, here's why should we sacrifice a whole other generation of problems to sustain the standard of living that we have? Reno, Las Vegas, you know, lighting the Eiffel Tower, overproduction of non-essential junk, transportation of all this junk from one place to another. I mean, you know, the solution, unfortunately, is benevolent dictator, because you cannot get this thing a solution without this incredible centralized power like they have in China. But what happened to China? The United States sold them all those cars, sold them on the vehicle production model. And now China is, you know, China had a chance to go the other way.
Mm-hmm.
And it got, because of corruption and unfortunately a very large and powerful and dominant criminal sociopathic culture that's dominating the world, that has the money and has the goals.
Okay, Anna, let me get a response.
I just
from...
don't think nuclear power is going to solve this problem, and it's tasty, it sounds good, but I don't really see a way out with the way the culture is now, and the fact that we're going to put in nuclear power to make more junk and light up cities. Like, we don't need all that. And who's going to tell these people that the real sacrifice is your quality of life, your standard of living, and your economy, and your jobs, and capitalism?
All right. Thanks, Anna. Appreciate that. A response from you, Joshua?
Well, so good for you for living on the batteries, but I've spent the last 40 years trying to preach to people to use less energy and so forth, and it's not working. They're not doing it. The world's using more and more energy, and especially the poorer countries. So it's just not practical. It's not happening fast enough to do that. But what I don't agree about is this sacrifice idea, and that we're either doomed or we're going to need to all shut down all our energy and go live in caves or something. And that's just not been the experience of countries that have used nuclear energy. And this is the difference with nuclear power from some of these other things, fusion or whatever. It's proven already. It's been done. Sweden did this. And when they did it, the emissions dropped in half in just 20 years. And the GDP went up 50% in that same time period. They had more money. They had cheap electricity. And they had a happy lifestyle. You know, Sweden is not, they have cold winters. They use more energy per capita than all but 10 countries in the world. So this is a high energy using, high income, very functional, healthy society. It just doesn't produce carbon emission while it does that, because they've switched over to nuclear power. And they're not a dictatorship. They're a democracy. So we know it's possible. We just have to be more like those countries that have already done this.
I want to ask again, because I'm getting some responses via email and on the call sheet here indicating that people think you're lying, or that you're trying to minimize the whole issue of the nuclear waste problem. And I want to give you a chance to explore this in terms of an argument you make in the book about there's a difference between scary and dangerous. Can you lay that out?
Yeah, so... scary is something that makes you really feel afraid, and dangerous, something that actually could hurt you. And right now, we need to understand the difference. Climate change is dangerous. and so is coal dangerous, but nuclear power and nuclear waste are scary. Now, we never quite finished the discussion of the waste, and I want to do that because mm-hmm. people wanted to know what happens long term. And here's what happens to the waste. In a U.S. plant, let's take, because the Swedes are a little different how they handle it. In a U.S. plant, the nuclear fuel is taken out of the plant and it's put in swimming pools, similar to that Swedish thing, just for a couple of years to cool off. Some of the radiation has a very short half-life, and after a couple of years, it's greatly reduced. Other of it, smaller amounts, has very long half-life. So you take the longer-term stuff out of the swimming pool, and it's put into these dry casks. They're cylinders about 18 feet high, concrete, and the radiation doesn't escape the concrete. I've stood right next to them myself with no protective gear, and the plant that we, a 1-gigawatt plant, which is a large power plant, produces about 2 of these cylinders per year, and they sit on concrete pads out behind the plant. They're certified safe for about 100 years or however long they need to be back there. So that's why Stefan says it's not an urgent issue to deal with them. And then when we're done with having them out back there, we have two choices. One, some of these new designs from the new companies we talked about, the startups, can use the old waste. The reason it's radioactive is it still has a lot of energy in it. So it's to use the waste as fuel in a new type of reactors. And it's not an entirely new type because Russia has a couple of these reactors already operating commercially.
All right. So now, obviously not an issue we're going to solve today. But
The second thing is to put it underground long term.
Okay.
But neither of those is nearly as serious as climate change, which is the thing we're really leaving the next generation.
All right. Joshua Goldstein with Stefan Kvist, the authors of A Bright Future, How Some Countries Have Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow. Thank you so much for joining us today, Joshua.
Thanks. I know it's controversial. People can learn more at brightfuturebook.com. That's the website, and I'm glad to be with you today.